Hello and welcome back to The Sound of Economics. I'm Nicholas Barrett.
And I'm Gottfried Wolf.
And today we are discussing AI, and more specifically the European approach to AI. How do we regulate algorithms? Can it be done? Is it possible? Today we're joined by two very distinguished guests. We have André Loskrug-Pietri from the Joint European Disruptive Initiative. Hi André, how are you?
Hi.
And we're also joined by Brett Mittelstraat from the University of Oxford.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So Guntram, tell us about the talk you gave today to our guests.
Well, thank you. We had today a meeting where Commissioner Vestager was attending and listening very actively to a group of scholars, Marietje Schacke from University of Stanford, Diane Coyle from the University of Cambridge, and José Carlos de Martín from the Politecnico in Milan, as well as to consumer organizations, labor unions, and, of course, major companies working in that field. And the guiding question was, what could be a European approach to artificial intelligence? I started my presentation by not only showing the massive technological progress that we've seen in the space, but then really identifying four major challenges. The first major challenge is the challenge to competition policy. So what does it mean if AI becomes better and better? What does it mean for competition in the markets? Is there a tendency that AI might, in fact, acquire and manipulate markets in a way that competition is undermined? A second important conversation was on the industrial policy and the innovation challenge, where I showed that in terms of patents, China and the United States are way ahead of the European Union in terms of patent activity and capacity to innovate in the space of artificial intelligence. The third is the social model. I mean, European citizens are very concerned about the impact of artificial intelligence, of robots on their jobs and on the social model. And that point was very much echoed, of course, by the unions. And last but not least, we had a discussion about ethical questions. So what does it mean that AI is intelligent but not conscious and takes decisions and perhaps knows you and knows society, knows you better than perhaps your spouse even? And so there's major questions here about what does it mean for our societies.
Yes, I enjoyed your metaphor for the flowers. Can you tell us that again?
Well, the metaphor for the flowers is that many social media platforms now, and there's experiments showing that social media platforms now know you better than your spouse when it comes to your preferences for flowers, after knowing just a few observations of your likes or dislikes on the social media feed. In fact, the AI may then be so smart that it actually knows that today you've forgotten the birthday of your spouse, and you're very late in buying the usual flowers that you buy for your wife. And you know, in fact, you might, the algorithm might then charge you a super high price, so perfectly priced to discriminate against you, which in a sense becomes an abusive price. So in a sense, there is a competition policy issue also, because the AI can be so smart that it can be abusive basically perfectly price discriminate.
It reminded me of the book about Michael Lewis about the algorithms that are taking advantage of the stock market and buying shares that they expect people to want to buy, and jacking up the price so quickly that nobody can compete.
Yeah, indeed. AI also in finance is a big issue. And if AI, all AIs are the same, well, then perhaps market trading gets undermined, and there's lots of hurting.
Mm. So Brent, with so few of us able to even comprehend an algorithm, let alone read one, how can democracy catch up to such a complicating and fast-moving operating system for the next century?
I mean, that's an interesting question. I suppose one way to do it is to not necessarily try to regulate the technology itself, but to try to regulate specific effects of it, specific risks, or just the sectors in which it's operating in, both to look at the regulations, the laws that you already have in place, the values, the ethical concepts that are behind them, and then to really identify gaps that you have. If there are new sorts of risks that are presented by AI, maybe you need to update the law. Maybe you need to you know, have a small update or a small new piece of regulation rather than an all-encompassing AI regulation. And so, for example, if we're thinking about things that are unique risks of AI, it has to come back to the number of features that a system could take into account at any given time, the amount of data that it can get through and how quickly it can get through it. These are the things that actually really challenge human comprehension and human reasoning. And so we can have a risk around opacity because we just simply can't understand, or the steps that the system took to make a decision aren't meaningful. We can be worried about the invasiveness of the inferences that can be drawn about us with all this data that's being gathered up and analyzed at scale. If we think about specific risks, then I think that leads us to a better starting point where we can actually make some progress and not have the regulation or have the law lagging behind the technology.
Andre, do any specific risks come to mind?
Well, I think the risks are everywhere. I mean, what is very new with AI is the computing power behind, and the fact that increasingly there's no such thing as ethics or values on one side and technology on the others. I mean, AI shows, take the example of face recognition, that is actually changing something that we've been used to since 250, 300 years, which is the social contract. In some countries, there is no more real difference between the central AI and or the state and the individual. I mean, this is merging into one large entity. When you look at deep fakes, you know, these fake videos produced by GANs, Generative Adversarial Networks, which is a branch of AI, they are going probably, these videos nobody can today tell, and increasingly so, which is true and which is not true, they will change the remaining trust that we have in the public debate. And think about it, the public debate is the fundamental of our democracies. So on that one, I think there is risk everywhere, but there's also probably an opportunity for the Europeans to actually invent the technologies of the future that will embed the values to which we are we are close and which are dear to our heart. And that has happened in history before, that the technology was able to change the name of the game, and always the good reaction was to say we need to stay on top of the game and then apply values. Just regulating and waiting for others to impose their technologies and the values upon us, I think, is the biggest risk that is facing us.
Mm. Now, because of the network effects that encourage this kind of innovation, a lot of the talent that builds the AI products of the future has become concentrated in a few areas around the world, like San Francisco and London, of course. And not many of those places are in Europe at the moment. Why is that?
Well, actually, when you take the example of Facebook, I'm going to quote a specific company. When you look at their AI division, which is in Menlo Park, a third of the people working there are French. 15% are Germans, and so on. And when you ask them why they are there, they will tell you, well, we work there because we have, obviously there's a bit of money involved, but most importantly, because we're working on frontiers, on science, etc. What we need to do as Europeans to ask ourselves, why are they going there? How can we attract them back, at least part of them? We need to give them both the flexibility, the frontier spirit, and I think it's an incredible moment in time where probably we can also attract people who are attached to the values that are probably increasingly European, which is not a free-for-all or a tech-for-tech. I'm oversimplifying, but that's what you feel in the Silicon Valley, or probably technology that is increasingly used for political purposes, which you probably see a bit more in Asia. So there is an opportunity, but for that, we probably need to radically change the way we approach science, research, technology in Europe, and experiment much more and be much more fast in the way we deploy this.
Jim, how do you think we can preserve a kind of experimental atmosphere while having the kind of regulations that reflect European values?
Well, it's a big question. Perhaps the first point to make, we ran our own little survey on Twitter just to find out whether our Twitter followers think that having high regulation on data protection, the European GDPR, is an advantage or a disadvantage to AI development in Europe. And while the majority was not very big, I mean, there was a majority of the people that answered that question on Twitter suggesting that it is probably a disadvantage. So in that sense, yes, there. I think there is a discussion here to be had to what extent regulation can undermine innovation. But it seems to me the much bigger issue is what André is pointing to. I mean, it's the capacity to have a single market, an ecosystem where the upside is also there for an investment, and to have people there, to have the universities, and to be able to attract people. And I would actually love to hear a bit more from André about, you know, what would it really take for Europe to be in the lead on these technologies, because these technologies, and I think that was also one point that was made a few times, these technologies are not just important economically for their own sake, they are also important in a geostrategic sense. I mean, there is now major concerns and major worries about the use of AI as a technology of the future, making major decisions, attracting not just value chains, but taking strategic decisions, military decisions, and so on and so forth. So this is really a strategic technology, and it's not just sort of yet another sort of product. It's a universal product, a universal technology that will be used in many, many areas, and that can determine quite a lot the competitiveness and the value creation of European businesses in the future. And so learning a bit more, I think, for André would be fascinating. What can we really do?
I mean, to build on your point, how important it is, and I don't think it's just a hype. When you look at the amount of data that has been generated since mankind exists, this has been multiplied by 10. I mean, from the data that was generated until 2012, we have multiplied that by 10 until now, and it will double again in the next 12 months. So we actually see this famous exponential when you look at that. What does this mean? It means that most of us have probably lost a bit of track of understanding the world. And that's where AI is important. It's basically everything about mankind is about decision making, be it policy making, be it business decisions, be it personal interactions. And if you have a tool that allows you to predict, to take better informed decisions, to filter, and then the big question is who filters for you, obviously, among the hundreds of emails you get every day, the hundreds of news, and we have our friend, quote unquote, in Washington that every morning at 6 o'clock on Twitter puts the world upside down. I mean, we are in this world where AI will give a competitive advantage to companies and to political systems that can include that in their decision making. So that's why it's so fundamental for Europe. And what does it take to be in the lead? You mentioned the single digital market. This is not my intimate conviction is it's not just about Facebook or Tencent that is hurting us. It is in our hands, and it's rather good news. The downside for every of these single technologies is the same everywhere. But the opportunity for these new technologies to make it big is obviously much bigger in markets like China and the US. So completing the single digital market would finally give us the tool to have the same competitive advantage than the others. And this is in the hands of policymakers. And I don't think how he can, even a citizen, accept. I understand from a policymaking, it's very sexy to announce an AI strategy, but how come we're talking Europe, and then we have a French AI strategy, a German AI strategy. We even have, with a lot of respect for our Belgian friends, a Belgian AI strategy. No wonder in 2 years we will lament that we don't have an AI unicorn, but it's normal. It's self-inflicted. So this should be a big priority, and this should be not done in a matter of years. It should be done in a matter of months, and this requires political courage.
Are there discernible differences between the Belgian AI strategy and the French AI strategy?
Unfortunately, yes. When you look at the ones I know the best, which are the French and the Germans, there is no connection. I mean, the French are building a lot on, all of them are having great ideas, but there is no interaction. I mean, there is this famous word in German at the end of the strategy saying, of course, we will have the Schulterschluss, which means the connection with our French friends. But we know that once there is a policy in a mandatory state that exists, it's very difficult to merge them. And this, in a world of big data, is obviously, I think this is some kind of a failure of our policymakers, sorry to be as blunt. And the second point I want to make is that actually there's a lot of hope, because it's not the end of history. At the contrary, these technologies shows that cards can be reshuffled, and it's up to Europe to invest not in the technologies of today, but in the technologies of tomorrow. It's all about, maybe tomorrow it's all going to be about small data. The good news is if you don't have big data, you don't also have the biases that come. It's all about personalized AI. You mentioned about the flowers and how some platforms know your buying habits better than yourself, Guntram. Imagine something, and even from a social point of view, that can be actually carried with you, where you have an AI system which allows you to make better decisions, but that is not in a platform somewhere away, but that you actually carry with you. It would help you, but will not be in the hands of somebody. We can think about also distributed AI that would allow face recognition, which will have a lot of impact on, you know, security of public spaces and smart cities, etc., but where you don't have a centralized database. Today, we think that we need a centralized database and big data to make it happen. No, and this is where we need to focus research and innovation on a European level.
You're an optimist, Bert?
Oh, I try to be. I don't know if I actually am in practice. No, I am, both in terms of AI being able to be used for good things and also for us to be able to govern it responsibly, to regulate it responsibly when that's needed. And I always like to emphasize that you have to have cooperation between disciplines, and in particular, you need ethics, you need law, you need technology, computer science working together, because for me, the best way, the most effective way to have both AI that does social good, that is a good thing, but at the same time is not just some form of a race to the bottom where we're giving up very significant things, you know, giving up our privacy, giving up our sense of autonomy, our sense of belonging with one another, in some sort of race to the bottom. And to have those things working together, you need to be asking the questions, you know. Ethics needs to tell you what it is that you're desiring, why you desire it, what's valuable, what are the things that, what is ethically desirable. The law needs to tell you what is actually legally required, what is, in current law, what are companies, what are developers required to do, and what are they maybe not doing. And the computer science technology is there to tell you, well, we have these values, we have these things that we want to bring into the world, these good things. What is actually technically feasible? Can we actually explain a algorithmic decision, for example? Can we explain black box models, or do we need to adjust our expectations as a society of our ability to explain and justify our decisions or choices to one another? Maybe that's the direction we're headed in, and then we can start to have a conversation around whether that's the right direction to head in.
Brent, can I ask you a bit on this point? I mean, one important question is, is it actually the right thing to talk about ethics? Shouldn't we just talk about complying with the law, you know, making sure that when there is a law, that law actually gets implemented and there is liability for not respecting the law? So in other words, when there's a law about privacy, if an AI breaches that privacy, you know, there is a punishment. When there's a law about non-discrimination, and the AI implicitly comes to a discriminatory outcome, well, the company that runs the AI actually needs to be held accountable. So perhaps you can walk us a bit through how this would work. I mean, how to operationalize this point about accountability, but also control and human control and human oversight. And there was this very interesting, I thought, a very interesting difference between the ethical principles that Google put forward, where they talk about accountability, while the high-level expert group of the commission was talking about human oversight and agency. which is not exactly the same thing. So I think there is here a big question about, you know, yes, there's ethics, but then there's respecting the law and, you know, how to make sure that companies, individuals, citizens, when they use these technologies, actually respect those principles.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question how ethics and law can work together best in this space. And at least as somebody that's been working in ethics for the entire time that at least I've been in academia, I've been very dismayed at the way that ethics is often portrayed. There's I think, increasing calls now to sort of abandon ethics in the space of AI, start to focus more on other frameworks, say human rights is quite often proposed. And to me, it's sort of a fundamental misunderstanding of what ethics is. Ethics is supposed to be there to help you raise the right questions of right and wrong. It's supposed to give you some sense of what's valuable in life and what's a good life. And really, it's supposed to be working in parallel, in cooperation with the law. I think the major problem that we have at the moment is that it's quite often conceived of as an alternative to the law, that we're going to have self-regulation or self-governance, and it will all be based on ethics and all be very loose as a result of that. And for me, what it should actually be doing is, if the law wears out over time, if the law is no longer responsive to the technologies we have, for example, if I am able to learn a great deal about you by learning about people that are similar to you, and I'm able to do that without using your personal data, or if I'm able to take your personal data and anonymize it and then learn about you or learn about a group of people that you resemble and then apply that knowledge back to you, we can argue that data protection law actually does very little to protect against that. And there's a clear opportunity to violate somebody's privacy and somebody's autonomy in that space. Ethics reminds us of why we have the law in the first place. It's not to protect data. It's not to protect identity. It's to protect people. It's to protect the people who are represented by the data that is being used. So this is a very specific case, but maybe in the space of GDPR, ethics will remind us that actually we need to revisit even the concept of personal data and start to expand the scope of the regulation in order to get back to the point where we're protecting the things that we actually value. And on the difference between the different sets of principles, I am more encouraged by the high-level expert group's approach because it's more specific. Human oversight has more sort of a definition to it. You can almost picture what that would mean in practice. Accountability is a very vague term. It can mean so many different things. I think it's sort of purposefully vague. It's if you agree on very high-level, very vague concepts, then it's very, very easy to actually comply with those because they can mean anything in practice. And that's really what we have in Europe right now. We have consensus around vague concepts and absolutely no idea what they mean.
Just maybe to build on the excellent point that Matt raised, on this topic of ethics being also almost a moral compass. And I mentioned before that we live in this world of exponential, where actually predicting the future begins to be quasi impossible. So regulation in a technical term will always run the risk of running behind the curve, and that we are increasingly in Europe in a defensive mode. And as we all know, the defense is good. We should not be naive. We probably have been very naive compared to a lot of these big platforms, but it's not going to give a perspective for the future. And so we need this moral compass in order to address the point of what we really want as a society. And here technology plays a role. So my call would be also to apply this concept of probably more agile governance or agile regulation, where you try it out, you assess, you try it out because it corresponds to your ethics, to your moral compass. If you realize it has unintended consequences, we need to be able to relatively quickly retract or adapt. So this is a bit probably a cultural revolution for the Europeans who spend a lot of time, I mean, I remind, 5 years for GDPR, and then consider, okay, work is almost done and next topic. So probably there's a third way for Europe, not necessarily in the technology, but in the way democracy adapts to this very fast-paced world. Because otherwise the risk is those countries with long-term capacity to think long-term, maybe because of systems that we don't agree with, will have always the upper hand in the capacity they have to overcome the short-term pressures or contingency that they have. So for me, it's even a problem of a challenge for our democracies. Can we reinvent the way we regulate and we apply common sets of rules for all citizens.
How do you imagine that working in practice? Whose job is it to say that this algorithm is not working for us?
Well, the good news is that there's a new commission, so they will have the difficult task of testing it out, and they put themselves a lot of pressure on doing 100 days for AI, 100 days on the Green Deal. So maybe this pressure on time will be a way to say, okay, we cannot find the magic formula, so we need to experiment. And I think we live in a world where three things matter, the moral compass, the capacity of experimenting, and speed of execution. I mentioned that we have this famous Moore's law about 18 months, doubling computing power. I mean, right now with AI, we see that this has actually diminished to 3 or 4 months, where the computing power you need to run the latest algorithms on AI is diminished to 3 or 4 months. So if we don't keep up with the pace, we will always be at a disadvantage. Now, I mean, one idea is that we are especially pushing at the joint European Disruptive Initiative is to think we need to invent a new way of not seeing the public service on one side and the civil society or the private sector on the others, but we need to combine this very important capacity to think long term, and probably Europe is the right level to be the holder of the long term, and the agility, the flexibility of, I would say, the civil society as a whole. We need to manage conflicts of interest. But if we manage that well, we can create some kind of a new form, also engagement of citizens. So you will have much less the top-down approach that sometimes is a critic that is made to centralized organization, be it at member state or at European level.
I'm not sure how you do that at a supranational level. Because I guess I completely understand what you're saying about it. It's very hard to have meaningful innovation if all these little nation states have their own AI initiatives and policies and so on. And the only way really to do it is have this kind of big centralized strategy that accounts for the whole continent. But I can't see how that wouldn't be top down. If you live in Greece or something or on the edges of Europe, there are laws about a technology you don't understand being written by people you don't know, thousands of miles away, hundreds of miles away, that's going to intimately and deeply affect the rest of your life.
Remember that in other circumstances of history, there was much more conjunction between public opinions and all over Europe compared to the very different point of view that the member states had from a political point of view. What we see, and I can tell you from experience, what we have started 9 months ago, which is bringing together all the technology leaders, and this is a not clear-cut concept, research organizations in technology, startups in deep tech, big corporates who are in technology, that actually the convergence in the 22 European countries we are in is so much bigger. There is some kind of an enthusiasm from the best scientists, the best technologists of saying actually these are the areas where we should focus on. And increasingly there's, especially in a small member state, this feeling that we cannot do like we a bit too much do at the European level, and I understand the political reason for that, where we both try to mix technological leadership, innovation, and redistribution. What we say that in these critical technologies that will be critical for tomorrow, there is a consensus of saying only excellence should matter. And this concept of excellence is as much accepted in Lisbon as is it in Paris or in Tallinn. Actually, it's maybe also a way for us to much more involve the new member states. And what I see in the Baltic states and the southern states, the quality of the research is incredible, but we just need to put this intellectual capital, the talent, because the data, the oil of tomorrow is not data, the oil of tomorrow is the talent. And we should not leave them go for the big platforms, which is actually happening right now.
Guntram, I was noting that I was raising some eyebrows across the table there. Was I being reductive?
No, I don't think you were reductive. Perhaps one point to react to is sort of this issue of, funding the best and the excellence. And of course, one important discussion now for the new commission is where will they put the money, right? Whether will they put the money on also on AI research. And it seems to me indeed that these, you know, having a second best technology doesn't help, right? Because basically these markets can be replicated. I mean, this technology can be replicated at almost zero cost, and so the best one actually takes the market, right? And so this is a big concern from a competition policy point of view, but from an innovation point of view, I have to say there's just no way that Europe can afford going for the second best. I mean, if we have to find our niche and have to find the specific space where, you know, we will actually be the leader. And I think an important point is that this is not just about AI. I mean, this is about digital much more broadly. I mean, it's about data centers, it's about cloud computing, it's about physical infrastructure where we are not in some countries certainly not doing so well. It's about then, and that's sort of the more geopolitical discussion, it's also about how do we make sure that you know, we preserve our economic and geopolitical sovereignty in some of these areas? Because you know, if we are vulnerable because certain technologies come from other and are controlled by other countries that are perhaps not well intended, you know, then this creates a vulnerability in the center of our economies, because everything is becoming data-driven, algorithm-driven, intelligence-driven. So in that sense, I think the new commission really has to be a geopolitical commission, which they want to be, which means they have to break down the silos also between the different areas and make sure that this is not just a little AI strategy here, a little data privacy strategy here, and a little single market strategy here. No, this is one thing, right? And this determines whether or not we as Europeans will be sovereign in the future or not.
Brent, I remember reading an article by Douglas Rushkoff about a year ago where he argued that if Mark Zuckerberg had stayed in university and not dropped out, he would have stayed at Stanford and he would have gone through the humanity courses as well, which would have made Facebook a lot more popular and social, for want of a better word, at this point in time. Do you think Europe can benefit from a more, shall we say, emotionally intelligent approach to these things?
It possibly could. I mean, in particular, I think we're starting to see ethics as being seen. It's starting to have a market value. There's certainly interest in certification schemes, in documentation standards, just in being able to basically put a badge on something and say, you know, we tested our system and it's fair, or we tested our system and it's not biased, it's not discriminatory, it's ethical in some way.
A sort of algorithmic stamp of approval.
Exactly. And you can understand the motivation for that. And ideally, you know, we should be doing all this sort of auditing, all this sort of testing before systems are ever actually released. And we should be doing it in each of the different places that the system's actually used and configured, to look at different sorts of data and to answer different sorts of questions. This is all good stuff if it's done properly, if it's done, you know, seriously. The problem with certification schemes is sometimes the appetite for them diminishes over time. The business model ends up not making any sense. And the problem in particular with these systems is a fairness mark that you earn by testing your system while it's in the development stage. It's good, but it doesn't actually guarantee in any way that your system is fair when it's actually being used in the real world for different sorts of problems, for different sorts of tasks. So it has to be, for me at least, if you want to do that, if you want to have some sort of standardization around say ethical AI or trustworthy AI, you have to look at it both from what are the minimum tests that are going to be required, the minimum expertise that's going to be required when a system's being developed, but then what are the requirements for auditing and reporting to the public, or reporting to your customers, or reporting to a regulatory body once the system's actually in use? How often do we need to check, for example, that it's not being discriminatory? If you can do that, if you can do this holistic approach to certification, to standards, then it could actually be both valuable in terms of its market value, but also, you know, protective.
And we should perhaps... go on.
No, what Europe needs to achieve is not just to be leader in values, but convert that into geopolitical and economic benefit. I mean, I was struck a couple of weeks ago. I was in Washington and in Union Station, which is the big railway station. When you arrive, there's a 90-meter... the whole hallway is covered by a huge billboard by Google saying privacy is our core concern. So we should avoid the situation that happened in the green technologies, where basically this ecological consciousness was basically invented in France and Germany and Europe 40 years ago, and today the Chinese are producing how much? 90% of the solar panels. We need to be able to convert this understanding that privacy is important from San Francisco to Brussels, even to Beijing, I would argue, but we need to convert that into economic and geopolitical benefits. So that's why speed and experimentation is key.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned ecology, because I guess one thing we lack in this is a word like ecology that brings all these kind of niche concerns together under one banner, because you think about 50 years ago, there were people who cared about owls, people who cared about whales, people who cared about forests. And until the word ecology came on, they didn't really realize that they all cared about the same thing. But I'm going to leave you with one final thought/question. I'm going to give everyone around the table a question to answer, and then I'll let you all go home. I was just thinking that the last huge technological revolution that we saw approximately 200 years ago, the Industrial Revolution, it took us over a century to understand the scientific implications of that. And even now, we're still trying to regulate it in a way that stops the entire world from becoming almost uninhabitable. It is possible that at this early stage in this technological revolution, none of us have any idea what we're dealing with. The magnitude, the scale, the historic significance. How do we get our heads around this? One at a time.
Let me start. I mean, the concept of autonomous systems, because that's what we're talking about, or augmentation of humans in their decision-making, in what is really the core of what makes us humans, is assess a situation, contextualize it, making an abstract concept of the world, thinking about things which do not exist. This is today beginning to be imagined by machines or autonomous systems. So this is really a revolution. Either we tackle that in order for us to master these problems. I mean, you mentioned about environment. The environmental crisis that we begin to realize is also a systems crisis. That means we realize everything is integrated, and that's why it's so difficult to have an impact on it. But maybe if we use it for good, I don't want to be overly optimistic, it's a way to augment our individual capacities and to work really as a human society and gather and multiply the intelligences together.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. My mind keeps going back to, there's always been the promise that technology is going to free us, and it's going to give us a two-day work week, and it's going to make, you know, we're going to have a life of leisure and be creative and all get to be artists. And it hasn't happened so far. I would argue that there's not really a reason to think that it's happening now with the advances we have in artificial intelligence. And it's difficult. I'm struggling here because I don't know.
you don't feel free.
It's not that so much. Yeah, maybe come back to me.
when you remember Aldous Huxley, I mean, people talk about, you know, the autocratic systems as being George Orwell. I think it's actually the danger, and I see the black side or dark side of that is actually that in Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, actually people fall in love with technology. And this is the biggest risk, is that we will see an increased divide in societies and those who use these tools to augment themselves and the others who will increasingly not use these tools and feel and understand less and less the world, this complex, always complexer world in which we are. And that is, for me, the biggest risk. So we need to address that.
Perhaps 2 points quick to end the conversation. I mean, one point is the artist's point, right? I mean, so we will all be freed and can be artists. Well, first of all, many of us aren't artists. I mean, let's face it. But even then, will we even be better than machines? And of course, there's now a lot happening also in AI-generated music. And, you know, can you actually distinguish an AI composed piece of music from a human composed piece of music, and the reality is that humans cannot distinguish it, and even sometimes think the AI composed music is nicer than the one composed by humans. So I think really what is happening here is we are at a moment in history where something happens that is, I think, very big and very fundamental, and I don't think we fully understand this. And I think the capacity of this technology to create intelligence that is vastly superior to our intelligence without having consciousness, I think that's really sort of, from a philosophical point, really something completely new, and I don't think we fully understand this.
Yeah, I think it's worth differentiating here between, are we talking about the hype, the promise of artificial intelligence, or what we can currently do? Mm-hmm. And to have a realistic sense of sort of how, of course we won't know, we can't know how artificial intelligence is going to reshape society in the future. What we can do is look at what it's currently doing, what it's currently capable of, and have sort of a realistic approach where we're trying to understand how it's changing us currently, how it might change us in the next couple of years, and try to direct it in a way that in some way aligns with our values. I always start to get worried when we think about what is the impact of the technology going to be in 10 years, in 20 years, in 50 years. If we go back and we look at fire, we look at cars, we look at smartphones, maybe somebody got it at least a little bit right about how it changed society, but 100 or 1,000 other people got it completely wrong. So I think focusing more on what's happening now, what is happening in this moment, and whether it's meeting our expectations and our values, that's where the real key is.
Oh, well, thank you, Brent, and thank you, Andre. Thank you very much for joining us. I think that was a very interesting conversation. I don't have artificial intelligence. I don't have access to huge sets of big data, but I can confidently say that people who liked this conversation are highly likely to like all our other conversations on the Sound of Economics podcast, and therefore should subscribe on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you very much for listening. Bye.